Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Chelly.
March, is it 30th? I think it's the 30th day of March, 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. Hey, this is the show you were looking for. You know why I know that? Because you're hearing me say what I'm saying. It is Thursday, and hey, we are going to broadcast live on Friars Day too, but no other live broadcast this week. I did release a couple of archive bits, and of course, Get Mad with Chris Graves. Quick network announcement before I get on with what it is I got to get on with, and I did go late to the live stream, about quarter after, but you hearing the podcast, you're not going to care, and you're really not going to care, but once I tell you what's going on tonight. But meanwhile, a quick announcement for the network. The Jack Blood Show is not going to run anymore on here. It is not because I threw him up or he quit in a huff or anything like that. It's just that his life situation has changed. He's not available Thor's days. He has an option to return if he would like. He used the word hiatus, going away from the network for now. I don't know what the future of his YouTube is or anything else. I'm not in control of that. But I know I won't be producing his show anymore on Thor's days for now, or at least until further notice. So I got to change all those graphics and schedules and stuff. And apologies to those of you that will miss him. But the Jackblood 360 show is not going to be on the O'Chelly.com radio network for now. Anyway, it will be available on the Magic Bullet archives and the other things that are coming up this year, and still available on the website if you want to catch some of the shows he did. But let me get all of that out of the way, and I can talk about it a lot more tomorrow night, Friday night, on the Open Mic Call-In Show, which we will be doing live also, because tonight I have Mike Swanson with me from WallStreetWindow.com. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. It's not just about Wall Street. And I'm going to cover a couple of news items here before we take a quick break and get to my second guest here on a Thursday. Rare occasion lately, I have author Larry Hancock with me. And just so happens Mike and Larry are going to talk about the same subject for a segment. And then after that, we'll let Mike go and get on with his life, because he's got other things to do. I mean, he's also an author himself, authoring the books that I highly recommend. Many others as well, by the way. You know, he's got a thing about the history of Danville, Virginia. He's got some financial books out there. He wrote the foreword to a book that his dad wrote that's about the Roman Empire. Indeed, but the books that I endorse wholly, completely, that is, not wholly as in, you know, godly, but wholly as in completely, The War State, and also Why the Vietnam War. Now, The War State's a book's been around for a while. If you don't have a copy yet, I don't know what the hell you're doing, and I don't know what you're reading, but you can improve the quality of what you're reading by reading The War State by Mike Swanson. But also, Why the Vietnam War is the first in a series of a planned 3 volumes on that conflict, and it contains stuff not available elsewhere, or at least it wasn't at the time of publishing. I think some people pick up on Mike's work, don't give him credit, and say that they discovered or they thought of something later. But we usually don't talk about that on this show. Anyhow, no pressure there, Mike. I want to get to a couple of news items with you before we get into the main thrust of the show when Larry Hancock will join us. But first of all, how you doing tonight, sir?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. Yeah, I'm real excited to speak with Larry also when he gets on here, because I wrote a – well, we'll get to it, but I wrote an article, and we're in a research community, so it's kind of like a peer review thing. You know, if you just write a post, other people can read it, and, you know, you can see the – it's about the Kennedy assassination. And
right.
So far, none of the low nutters have disagreed with it, so
– Oh, so you're – yeah, you're not being attacked
interesting.
Yet. You know, I'll tell you, that's the funny thing. I anticipated attacks from Larry's last appearance where we focused on the Kennedy assassination because, not because of what Larry had written, but our other guest, who I'm going to bring back on, who's got some really interesting points of view and some fresh thoughts on some old portions of the topic. So Greg Doudna, you know what? Now I can't remember how to pronounce his name properly. I'll get corrected again. But anyway, Greg gave an interesting presentation there that I thought nobody wanted to hear, and some people might get angry about regarding the Walker shooting. Crickets, Mike. But it's great when you put out a research article, and this isn't just in the Kennedy assassination research community, but across communities because I've dealt with a few of them. I'll tell you something right now. I'm dealing with a bit of research, and it's funny. Nobody's talking about certain aspects of this this shooting event in Nashville. Now, here we go, right? A lot of people are probably thinking, uh-oh, has Chuck bought into the Sandy hoax issue? Has he gone that way? No. I'm rational, and I require evidence. So here's the thing. There's evidence for a whole other hidden narrative, though, behind this, and I don't necessarily mean the gun-grabbing narrative. I do mean a whole other one that is being absolutely ignored by the alternative, by the mainstream media, of course, and by the general public, because I think they're unaware of what might be going on there. Yeah.
You know, topics like that, there's that shooting in Las Vegas several years ago. Mm-hmm. I mean, this guy killed, there are over 30 people.
Right.
And they never really gave a motive for it. They investigate it. They still never released an official motive. The closest they came was just basically saying the guy was crazy.
That's not really
a motive.
There you go. Mike, hang on a second. Look, the guy was crazy. Not a motive, not an explanation. And you know what? There's a lot of crazy people out there that don't pick up a gun and do stuff. Let's just say that's even legitimate. And by the way, allegedly crazy, I don't know that he was crazy. No matter how you want to slice this, right? They're just using the crazy guy thing because they want to grab our guns. They want to take our guns. Or, you know, look, this is the people ignoring the mental health issue, and it's almost like a script. I mean, come on. The guy is crazy. I'm not criticizing you, Mike. What I'm saying is, it's not a motive. It's not an explanation.
Last year, I go to casinos occasionally, mm-hmm. and I was sitting at a bar in one, and I happened to meet these two people that just sat down next to me,
right.
And they are retired police officers, and after they retired, they told me guards in Las Vegas. And they were telling me all these stories, and during the conversation, I brought up this shooting, Paddock or something was his name,
right.
And they told me what the motive was, and they told me that these police people they knew told them what they thought the motive was, and that was the guy lost a lot of money and just decided to take revenge on the casinos.
By
trying to hurt their business.
But there you go.
Well,
look,
that's a better motive than just saying he's crazy.
Well, that makes a lot more sense. And quite honestly, again, having lived really close to Atlantic City, and by the way, I mean it. If you go to Atlantic City, I want to try and figure out a way I can hitch a ride with you, because telling you, I'd love to just go back to Jersey. I miss the toxic lands of Jersey. But you know, frankly, having lived near Atlantic City, I was well accustomed to things that never made the news anymore because, look, there was one particular parking garage, I'm not kidding you, Mike, where guys that, you know, lost their house would jump from. I mean, I know I'm laughing, but it was
these people told me that too, that was a common problem.
It's a recurring event, yes. Yes, I mean, look, I know there's a lot of jokes that people make, and I mean I even played the Family Guy commercial from the allegedly the New Jersey Tourist Bureau, you know, come flick a lit cigarette at a dealer, and watch a guy with no eye get into a fight with somebody with a false limb, and while you're at it, you know, lose your house and all this other stuff. Come to New Jersey where the bodies float out in the ocean. There is something to that. People losing all their money, losing their minds in a gambling establishment is not unusual to begin with. Not even about vengeance, just, you know, they snap. Did anybody want to talk about that? No. Because what would that do? That might hurt tourism. Because, you know, I mean, I'm sure that Las Vegas can't take a hit. But look, triple entendre there. Look, there's always a lot more to these stories. And the unusual thing here regarding this latest shooting is there's a completely ignored string of events. I'm sure somebody's going to get to it. And it has to do with legal proceedings previous to this event in Nashville. So I'm working on that, and I possibly lit a fire under a couple of other people in alt media, and wanted to see what they would do with it. Something other than the general narrative, something other than the MSM, you know. Oh, well, gee, now we got to talk about gun control and mental health, of course. Thoughts and prayers also, I mean, depending on what channel you're on. But in addition, how about covering the story? How about looking at what is a motive? What is the background? What is the history? Nah, let's not do that. I mean, that would be like what? Investigative reporting. Anyway, I'm working on that, just so you know, people know. I don't know what conclusion I'm going to come to because I don't have a preconceived notion, by the way. But interesting thing did hit the headlines today that I guess could be the 400-pound orange elephant in the room, if you don't mind. You want to talk about that for a minute? I mean, I'm not sure what you're read in on regarding today, the big announcement of the Trump indictment. You got any thoughts yet, or do you want me to just spew a few facts and factoids?
Well, honestly, I didn't know about it. This is opening day baseball. I was watching that, and you told me in a message that Trump has been indicted related to this National Enquirer and paying off Stormy Daniels. And
yep.
I guess he used campaign funds or something.
Well, look, there's allegations here. That is the most salacious of them, right? But there's a bunch of misappropriation of campaign funds and this kind of thing, you know, falsifying some documentation, whatever. And that's all in the Southern District of New York. And apparently, and here's the funny thing. This was not the official announcement of an indictment yet. It was actually filed under seal somewhere around 5:30 p.m. today. So, you know, at the end of the day, when somebody was concluding their paperwork from the judge's chambers, this is when this happened. Now, the New York Times has made a big deal out of it right away. They're at the tip of the spear regarding the reporting. But here's the funny thing. It hasn't been officially announced. Nobody knows what the charges are specifically directly, right? Indictment has been filed, again, under seal. And the prediction is that they'll probably get to it, you know, tomorrow or the next day, actually dropping it out there in the public. But it's very likely, and Trump has already communicated, he's been informed about it through Truth Social, and I'm assuming a couple other outlets he's probably gotten to. I'm not keeping the best track of it just yet, but that is the state of the state regarding this, right? That there is actually an indictment, and the headlines are reading.
I like to just point out that, you know, this happens in other countries. In Argentina, the president there was indicted. The current president of Brazil spent time in jail and then got out and ran for president again and won. Right. It's happened in Taiwan. And in our country, it's not 100% unprecedented. During World War I, Woodrow Wilson put in jail one of the people that ran again, that had run for president in the past, mm-hmm. and he ran for president in jail. And that is Eugene Debs. And the reason was that I don't remember the name of the act, but he was against World War One, mm-hmm. and that was illegal.
Well, see, those are candidates
against it. So yes. he had to go to jail for that.
Right. Now that is a candidate. It is unprecedented, however, to have a former president indicted.
That's not happened. United States, that's true.
In the
sure.
United States, correct. But just saying, there is your big history-making headline, right? For the first time ever, a former president has been indicted. Okay. First of all, official announcement not made yet. It has been done under seal. This doesn't mean that an arrest is absolutely necessary. However, some form of processing or booking might be necessary for indictment. So, you know, are we now looking at the arrest, possibly, or a surrender, and what is he going to do with this? Well, I'll tell you what he's going to do with it, because he's already doing it. He's raising funds, okay? Immediately, hey, I'm under attack, you got to support me, help me pay my legal bill. He's already fundraising, and he's already crying political foul, et cetera, et cetera. And it is what it is. Now, at the end of the day, spoiler alert, I'm fairly certain that nothing at all will come from this, and I did say at all, trying to be comical here, but fact is, I think he'll go to prison right beside any other former president who's gone to prison, which is, guess what, none of them. regardless of their actions. And Woodrow Wilson, just for the record, Woodrow Wilson was a New Jersey-based scumbag who was a president. So, you know, looking to him for any sort of anything other than a footnote in history, not great. Okay, I'm just saying that's my opinion. Mike Swanson does not necessarily share my opinions on this at all. But, again, I had to learn about this guy. There's lots of stuff in New Jersey named after him, by the way, Woodrow Wilson. But, you know, the headlines of the day, how was baseball, Mike? Since you watched that and you did the much healthier thing mentally than I did today, how was baseball today, in short?
Well, I was happy to watch it because the team I root for won. So the Orioles, they beat the Red Sox.
There you go.
It was a good day for me. Maybe.
There
might
you
not
go.
Be like that tomorrow or Saturday, but it was a good opening day.
See, baseball is a wonderful thing because you got to be patient. You know, it's not like you got to build up everything to 1 week like football. It's not like prize fighting where everything is dependent upon those particular, you know, what do you get there, 3x12, 36 minutes of combat. You know what I'm saying? It comes down to a very sort of long-term game strategy, right? I mean, you got to win more than you lose, that's all, and it's real casual and kind of laid back. Baseball is an enjoyable game to me psychologically, but I probably should have just watched that today instead of reading this stuff and doing other research, but I'm a glutton for punishment. Anyway.
Well, Mike, I am curious. I did look at the odds, this predicted website that that's contracts, they trade in real time.
Right.
I was curious if the news changes any of the odds of who's going to get the Republican nomination and who's going to be the president. And the odds of Trump getting the nomination are 44%, and they've dropped by 3%. So they're 47% before the news. They've fallen by 3%. That's not a massive swing. And the odds, according to this, are that the Democrats – will win the White House in 2024.
Okay, anybody?
They haven't really changed.
Quick disclaimer: I love that predicted website. I don't play on it, but I'll tell you, I want to. But there's an issue with me being able to give them my proper ID, so I can't do it. But I will tell you this: if you're somebody who can gamble on this kind of stuff, which you can, and it's only like a dollar bet, where you know you bet a percentage to try and win a dollar, and I guess you can bet as many times as you want. I'm not sure, but if I'm a gambling man, I would definitely go against those odds. And Trump, I think, is going to be more likely the nominee, number one, now that this is going on. This is going to be completely weaponized and turned around to his supporters and to people who are questioning him. I think it's going to build momentum and support for him. It's going to add to his MSM coverage, which will probably return to 24/7 right on time for the campaign, just like it did in 2016. So have no fear there. He's going to get more press coverage. He's going to definitely solidify his spot unless something very crazy happens in between now and then. I think this helped him. And I would bet against the Democrats retaining the White House in 2024 at this point. Okay. Now, I'm not necessarily saying I'm giving gambling advice here, but I'm just saying that theoretically, if somebody wanted to bet me a dollar, I take the side of, guess what, Trump being the nominee and winning in 2024, if I'm gambling on it, you know, at a dollar. You want to take me up on it, Mike? I'll bet you a dollar, a straight physical dollar. I'll mail it to you if I'm wrong, and you'll mail it to me if you're wrong. What do you say? I say Trump not only gets the nomination. Tell you what, we'll make it a dollar each thing. A dollar on Trump getting the nomination, and a dollar he wins the White House.
Well, I think it'd cancel out. I think he'll get the nomination, well, okay, but won't get the White House.
Okay. So. Well, look, it's $2 at stake, right? And it could be that neither one of us gets anything because I'm right about one and wrong about the other. But what do you say? You want to take me up on it?
So it's two bets.
It's two bets. Okay. $1, I bet you he gets the nomination. And
okay,
another bet, $1, he gets in the White House. A dollar each. What they used to call this a gentleman's bet, right?
Well, I think we'll just cancel out. I agree with you. I think he will probably get the nomination. I don't think DeSantis is going to catch on that much outside Florida.
Well, okay, so if I'm wrong, though, I'm wrong twice. If he doesn't get the nomination, I mean, it's highly unlikely he would get in the White House. So I'm wrong twice if he doesn't get the nomination, right?
Yeah, that's true.
So you want to take me up on it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it'll it doesn't matter. I just think you'll win one. I would win the other in that scenario.
Fair enough. But, you know, let's do this. Okay. So now we have publicly bet a dollar and a dollar. Okay. So that's that. For entertainment purposes only. This is what we've done. And you know what? We need to get to a break here because I'm already about 7 minutes deep into the time when I said I was going to call Larry Hancock, because I want to move on to another subject, and I think we've already said what we need to say about the alleged Trump indictment or whatever. But stick around, because Larry will have free time to talk to me about anything he wants after we get through the next segment. So you cool with that, Mike, or you got anything else you want to add?
Yeah, sounds
in?
Good. Sure.
All right. So let's go to break here on the Ocelli Effect on a Thursday. Stick around. Larry Hancock will join Mike Swanson and I in the next segment. And we'll get deep on a subject we all know quite well. Stay tuned.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
The Ocelli.com radio network.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? It's a thing called nuclear weapons and other things, like lots of, you know what uranium is, right? Bad things. Things are done with uranium, including some bad things. Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? I've been briefed. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? It's a thing called nuclear weapons and other things, like lots of, you know what uranium is, right? Bad things. Things are done with uranium, including some bad things. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust. Nuclear Holocaust.
Every time I put it on my face, I'm able to breathe just a little bit deeper.
What are people saying about MyTrueEssence.net?
I'm going to tell you something serious, man. I just want to tell you listeners, I bought some of that Modifilin from Christy, and she made me up some of this emu oil mixed with some other stuff. I don't know what's in it, but I like the way it smelled. And I started putting it on, rubbing it on my foot, rubbing it on my knee, and like the second day, I just noticed it. I'm walking around, I'm like, damn, my knee is loose.
I can tell you that oil you gave me helped me with my carpal and my shoulder problem. And if it wasn't, I wouldn't be working.
My ankles started to really be pesky and bother me. And I'm telling you, the pain just went away. That's the oil's rule.
And when I put that on, it's like my skin came alive.
MyTrueEssence.net.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Going to Chuck Ocelli.
Chuck Ocelli, you know it's Chuck Ocelli.
You are about to embark upon the great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely, man to man. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Segment number two of the Ocelli Effect. Now, I didn't mean to play that intro, but it makes sense. That is the voice of our former president, Dwight Eisenhower, but he wasn't president yet, I think, during that particular speech. Anyway, you could look it up. I did edit it some when I created that bumper, and edited tapes. I think that's going to come up. We're joined by author Larry Hancock. He is the author of many a book. Of course, I talk about this all the time. He occupies more spaces on my physical bookshelf than any other author. Let's mention a few. Surprise Attack, Creating Chaos, Someone Would Have Talked. Turn Back Around. What else we got? Oh, right, Unidentified, a few other things. Maybe we'll get into that in the third segment, Unidentified, spoiler there. And also still have author and website man, you know, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, Mike Swanson. Of course, he's worn a lot of hats, but interesting piece of writing he did this week regarding a subject which Larry Hancock, myself, and Mike all have in common. We're going to get to that, but before we do, Larry Hancock, how are you?
I'm doing good. Enjoying the early days of spring. That always cheers me up.
Absolutely. Look, it's different weather where you are sometimes. I know that that's been kind of odd lately, but hey, what are you going to do? And you're hard at work on a lot of stuff, and we're going to get into a few of those things, hopefully, in the third segment. But before we get there, yeah, again, I mean, I'm just going to kind of drop it over to Mike and let him explain what it is that he decided to write about. Maybe you could tell us why, too, Mike. I mean, after all, the tapes of the president, I mean, I know it's very popular right now. People are creating lots of TV shows, and people are watching things like Gaslit and stuff like that, talking about Nixon and his tapes. I think HBO's about to drop a new series. They're calling The Plumbers or something. Seems like every streaming service has something about Nixon and his tapes right now, because we did have that 50th anniversary just go by, right? But, you know, there's that, but there's been other tapes, haven't there? And maybe this one has something to do with, I don't know, JFK? Not necessarily, but how about his successor, LBJ? So I'll leave the setup there, and maybe you could explain to people, you know, brass tacks. I mean, we know what you're talking about, me and Larry, but somebody who's unaware, and also, you can pick up on this particular post at WallStreetWindow.com, right?
Yeah, it's on there right now, and hopefully you link to it in your show notes, but certainly they may be able to find it in Google if they type "The Mystery of the Missing JFK Assassination Related LBJ Presidential Tapes," because that's what I titled it. And the Miller Center has put out volumes of transcripts of these tapes. And I have the first set that concern Lyndon Johnson and the weeks, or actually months, after the assassination, the day of the assassination, the next day and afterwards. And they're transcribed. One of the first conversation in the volume that's transcribed is actually, the audio is ruined. Rex Bradford of the Mary Farrow Foundation did an article about that years ago. It's been seemingly recorded over. It's inaudible. Mm-hmm. And as far as I knew, that was the only conversation like that. But I found by happenstance that there's more. I kind of stumbled into looking at these tapes in more detail because what happened was I wanted to look and see if I could find out what Lyndon Johnson's daily movements were, who he was talking with and meeting with in the days leading up to the assassination. Mm-hmm. So I went to the LBJ library and all the, what they have online, and found his daily diary. And it carries on from when he's vice president and when he's president. And I've got, you know, this right on the post that I wrote, so people can see exactly what I'm looking at. I got a link to the PDF.
Right. Now what just, it shows. Yeah, let me just step in and interrupt you for a second. First of all, I put the link to the article in the live chat room at Ocelli.com. If you're not aware, well, we do exchange information and put links there. But also, it'll be included with the show notes, the link to this article. And just a note for somebody who might not be fully initiated, a little bit green with the JFK assassination. The tapes of Lyndon Johnson immediately following the assassination have been at issue several times. People have brought out certain very interesting discussions between, say, him and J. Edgar Hoover, etc., over the years. A lot of this stuff is available through the Johnson Library. You used to have to actually buy the tapes from them, you know, cassettes. I know, Grandpa, relax. But, yeah, we used to have to get them that way. But nowadays you can download a lot of this stuff. And various copies have been made and sent around. The mainstream media focused on Johnson's discussions. People have made a bunch of different issues out of what it is they think he was trying to do or communicating or what have you. Also discussions, the very earliest discussions about the setup of the Warren Commission and stuff like that have been gone over by many a person. Those tapes have been shared, rebroadcast, etc. But this is not what you're talking about necessarily, although it's in the same ballpark. So you're telling me that nowadays we can go get this from the Johnson Library online, which is a change, but you can't get all the tapes from the Johnson Library online or all the transcripts or can you, Mike? I mean, tell us about that.
Well, they're supposed to... I need to ask them and see what their answer is. But what happened was I found that there's conversations that aren't available. Mm-hmm. They weren't listed in this transcript of this Miller Center. And the Miller Center and LBJ Library have all the tapes that are available on both their websites. So you can listen to them. Okay. And I have listened to some of them. But what I found was there's conversations with McGeorge Bundy in particular, and I counted four of them on the 22nd, on the 23rd, that are listed in this diary, but they're not online anywhere. Hmm. And one of the conversations may be up to an hour long, and it happens right before all these subsequent, conversations that are out there in meetings that we know about.
Right.
On the 23rd, that are all about forming the Warren Commission. So before those discussions about the Warren Commission happened, it looks like it dominated pretty much his entire morning.
Yeah.
He spoke of McGeorge Bundy first for what could be up to an hour, which an hour is a long time to be talking with somebody. I mean, that's more than someone calling you and giving you information.
Well, right. And somebody might say, Mike, just really quickly here, somebody might say, well, look, is this part of, you know, classified? And I know Larry's going to have to come in and comment on some of this stuff soon. But, I mean, somebody might say, well, maybe some of this stuff is still classified, Mike. I mean, after all, because the president, here I go, I'm trying to take the benign viewpoint, right? The president is now the president. He was the vice president. So in the process of taking the reins, there may have been communications that maybe the public doesn't need to know because there is still as yet classified information contained in those conversations, right? If that's the case, though, don't you normally get a notice? I mean, when you got, you know, the pink slips from the National Archives are one thing, but even from the Kennedy Library, we used to get notices that basically said, look, this is still being withheld for whatever reason. They would usually explain that when they had a catalog of something like a collection of tapes. Was there an explanation that came along with this missing McGeorge Bundy stuff?
No, there's no explanation like that. But I found a statement on you know, in their archives for the for this audio stuff okay. that says all the conversations have been released that have anything to do with the assassination.
I see.
And basically, it's all been released. And
so they're saying that they've
I have no reason to doubt that.
You know, but they're saying that they have complied with the JFK Records Collection Act, which is to release all relevant stuff like this that might pertain to the assassination. And that was the mandate of the law that was passed, basically. I mean, in layman's very shorthand terms, what they're basically saying is, look, we've already released everything that's pertinent to that. And it's available to you right here through this wonderful service that we have, right? So that's that. It should all be out there if it's available. Now, on the other hand, you have some stuff. You started to mention some things were destroyed or whatever, right? Or were inaudible, I think was the word you used, which is fine. Yeah. Magnetic tape could have been damaged, could have been lost, could have been recorded over literally, you know, in transport, transmission, moving things, I mean, God knows what. Again, benign explanation. There could be stuff that was simply lost due to damaged devices, damaged recording, damaged paperwork, whatever. Some things could have been lost just along the way, and we are talking about 60 years ago now, almost. Not quite. Not quite. We're getting there, though. But almost 60 years ago, not everything surviving. There's another possibility, but again, there would be a note that would probably say, look, this existed, but now has not survived for one reason or another, right?
Yeah. So in regards to that, there's four tapes on the 24th mm-hmm. that they categorize one as machine noise. And that's what, if I remember right, the one Rex Bradford discovered, which is a real critical one where John's talking with Hoover. They categorize that one as machine noise too. If I remember the description of it correctly from what he found way back then. But these tapes have archivist notes that I was able to see, and one of them says can't hear anything on this, erased on slip. Another one says two calls, phones out of order. All Young again, which most likely refers to Whitney Young, because what you see is there's two, and these are very short calls. So I don't know if I don't really know what it is. Mm-hmm. I mean they're less than 2 or 3 minutes, and in between them there's this call to Whitney Young. So it could be an error in the machine, you know, when LBJ was operating it, or I really have no idea.
Well, a variety of things have occurred.
Go ahead.
No, a variety of things have occurred with these tape recordings, especially in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, where you have a malfunctioning tape recorder, you have somebody dictating something into the tape recorder as opposed to the actual recording. I mean, a bunch of things have come up like this that I've found over the years. Some of it is not, you know, critical. And it's just, you know, oddly, things have just occurred like this. Also, look, human error. Somebody forgot to press record, whatever, or somebody pressed record. Machine noise, yeah, that's something that happens too. Maybe maintenance was not kept. A variety of things have happened. And so, I mean, there's those possibilities
too.
There's
some, like I'm saying, that they're like these McGeorge Bundy ones, and one of them is very long, and they're just missing. And mm-hmm. You know, they're not there. They don't exist. That may be the better way to put it. And I don't, you know, all I can think of is two possibilities. Either LBJ didn't record these calls, didn't operate the machinery, or they were destroyed, you mm-hmm. know, long, long time ago.
So here's where Larry
said a little bit more context on how the recording occurred. LBJ did not turn on and off a recorder.
Okay.
This recording equipment is set up and was ordered set up by JFK to record everything that went on. Mm-hmm. That's why we have the Nixon tapes. If Nixon mm-hmm. had been turning on and off tapes, we wouldn't have the Nixon tape. The recording system was put in place by JFK to establish a historical record. No president since JFK has done anything like that. But it's not a matter of Johnson turning on and off a recorder to record his call. The system is just running. Mm-hmm. So if something is there, certainly you could have had a malfunction. I will comment that when Rex Bradford investigated the 14 minutes that you were talking about and actually pursued the matter with the Johnson Library, the Johnson Library investigated it and was forced to admit that, no, it was not machine noise, it wasn't machine error. Literally, that section had been erased.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a bit more reason to be suspicious. The other thing I would point out is maybe you should elaborate on who's actually making a record of these calls. I mean, are you really saying that Johnson took the time to write down the time of the call and who he was calling and how long he spoke with them?
I'm not really sure who's putting the
couple things here, Larry.
His
then
calls
yeah,
were placed by a secretary.
Right.
Johnson didn't mm-hmm. do that sort of stuff.
Right. Right.
Yeah, that makes sense. That he wouldn't be.
Not that Johnson couldn't make. There's was a literal call log
right.
that was placed by the secretary as she's placing these calls.
Right. So
it's, that makes
it's
sense.
An official record of what the president is doing. So again, we're not dependent upon Johnson actually recording all this, either operating a recorder or recording his calls. This okay. is being done separately.
Let's lay this out properly then, Larry, because here's a couple of things that are all going to come up. One, you have the actual operation of this occurring, which is there's somebody who works at the White House switchboard who's handling these calls. They are keeping a log of who's calling or who is being called. Okay, and that's happening in real time at the time. The taping system, which was put in by JFK, was upgraded and altered a bit, but maintained through the Johnson administration and into Nixon, obviously. But that's what it was there for, was to keep a historical record. And probably people didn't even know that this existed until Watergate era, when Alexander Butterfield made the statement testifying before Congress. Again, correct me when I'm done here, but really quickly, so there is somebody keeping a log as a matter of being an operator. There is the Johnson notes where he was keeping track of things he was doing, which I do believe there is some notation, which I think Mike referred to as the diary. So there's that. That is separate from the operator. And then there are archivists who got a hold of this stuff afterwards. Now, what do they have to do? Go back over, look at the log, compare it, and make their own notations about what is contained. Because even if somebody attempted to record, or there were recordings, or there were actions going on, now somebody has to actually account for it and catalog it, right?
Chuck, when you describe it like that, what basically happened was mm-hmm. I'm familiar with the record that the Miller Center has put together
okay.
for these calls. And then I'm looking at I just look at the diary. You know, because I want to track something. I have other questions. I wasn't originally looking about these calls. I wanted to see what Johnson was doing for the assassination. And I've turned to these 2 days, and I'm like, well, this doesn't match the record of the Miller Center that I'm familiar with. And I got the volume right in front of me and, you know, took a picture of it. So and I was like, something's wrong here. And then I just knew the calls are missing, you know, and they didn't tell us that they happened.
So what you have there?
I'll give you another example of that makes what you found even more relevant, and I think more serious to me. I first came across this about like 2005, 2006, because I was looking at the same thing you're looking at: Johnson's calls before the assassination, Johnson's calls after the assassination, and I was comparing those to what various people were saying who had talked to Johnson, you know, like, okay, yeah, he did call me and we had this conversation, mm-hmm. you know, cross-checking it to what they were saying anecdotally. But I was also cross-checking it against what was, for example, William Manchester probably mm-hmm. did the most thorough job of taking that log and writing about it, because Manchester was really trying to document the history of everything that happened during the assassination and immediately following the assassination.
Right.
And so he actually goes in to that log and listed out, you know, who Johnson was talking to for how many minutes. You know, very, very specific. It's not just who he talked to, when he called them, but how many minutes he talked. And so I started cross-checking it the same way you're doing. Like, okay, Manchester goes at length to describe a call on Friday night after the assassination between Johnson and J. Edgar Hoover. I'm going, wait a minute, that's not in the diary. That's not in the there's nothing that would indicate that these two men talked, other than when Johnson talks, that introduces the conversation Saturday morning. It's like they're just restarting. It's like he's going, how are things going with this Mexico City thing? You know, J. Edgar, like we talked. So there's nothing. And what I found then that was really stunning to me, and I think you've taken this a lot further, is when I went back to check, Manchester's description of that call, including the specific timing, is no longer in the call log. Mm-hmm. Somebody literally redid that call log to take it away. Mm. Because Manchester did see it, and as we've learned, both with this and the records from Air Force One, there are things that literally, under Johnson's review, like the Air Force One tapes, things disappeared. Not immediately, mm-hmm. not the first 24 hours, but like over the first year, over the first series of months, things that happened. Things that people talked about talking to Johnson about, oh, well, we got together, gone. So I'll hand it back to you, but what you found is more suspicious based on this other stuff than people might think it would be.
Well, before you hand it back over to Mike, I just want a little clarification on something, because both of you mentioned the diary. What is it that you're specifically referring to when you're talking about the diary?
Well, the LBJ library is calling it the Daily Diary, and you know, I've got images of it on the site, and what it shows is for these 2 days, mm-hmm. who Johnson's meeting with and who he's talking with on the telephone. It's giving a list of all the phone numbers. Now, the days before it, it's also showing his movements, which I found real interesting. But these 2 days, he's not moving around that much. He's great. Mostly in, you know, staying at the White House. It does say like attended President Kennedy's funeral. But to piggyback a little bit on what Larry was saying, mm-hmm. One of the things in here that to me was real interesting was Johnson spent over 2 hours with President Eisenhower on the 23rd, and it's basically saying in here he's asking for his advice. I mean, this is, you know, from like 11 to 1 o'clock,
right,
the day after the Kennedy assassination, while they're meeting, John McCone comes in, and elsewhere it said that he gives Johnson an update on Oswald's supposed doings in Mexico City.
Now, John McCone, for the uninitiated listener, is at that time the director of the CIA. And what you're telling me is that this is notes that are taken by Johnson accounting for his day, though. This is the diary. He's the author.
Yeah, this is the Daily Diary. Okay. But to me, that's an interesting fact, because what it means is that Eisenhower was kind of read in on what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I think that's not a diary that Johnson is completing, unless I'm mistaken. This is a secretary.
That would make more sense.
Johnson personally.
No. That's why I'm asking the question. Okay. But
to piggyback on what you're saying about things missing in the entries, on this LBJ library, as I was looking at this, they also have all these photos from that day. And I was looking at them, and it turned out, it's not listed here, but anywhere. But Harry Truman also came to the White House and was there at the same time Eisenhower was. And there's a photograph of Truman at the same table that LBJ and Eisenhower were at. But Eisenhower's not in that image. And I get the impression, I think Truman is talked about in the Manchester books. I need to go check, see what he says about it. But I get the impression he was only there for a few minutes, not for very long. Mm-hmm. Whereas Eisenhower really spent, I mean, to me, it's a lot of time. You know, the two or three, we'll put it this way, it looks like he met with him
right.
on that day for a longer amount of time than anyone else.
There's an interesting thing which is publicly observable during the time when the news basically went live to a 24-hour cycle in between the initial events in Dallas that early afternoon and then all the way up to and including the funeral, where the news was broadcasting constantly. There was a rush of former presidents, political leaders, past and present, all going through the same hallway, up to D.C. and meeting with everybody. Yeah, go ahead.
Before we start talking, I went back and looked and found there's a YouTube clip of this, this Eisenhower thing. And what it is he is giving a – he's talking to the press, and it's that evening – and he was at a dinner, he says, and he makes, you know, they're really, his statements are very interesting since I remember him, but he says that he doesn't want the country to be stampeded by the event of the assassination. He trusts that the American people, you know, won't, now I can't remember the exact phrase, but basically, you know, won't panic, and they'll trust they won't turn against the government. So to speak. But he makes a comment. They ask him what are his plans.
Mm-hmm.
And he basically says he doesn't have any. I'm going back. I think he said he was going back to his home.
Mm-hmm.
But after that meeting, or after this, and this is aired on television, after this, talk Eisenhower has that's on TV.
Mm.
Obviously, the plans had changed, and he's sent to Washington D.C. and I think they call Truman too. Mm. And both of them make statements later on the 23rd. Basically, I think they're displaying continuity in the government. There's pictures of Truman. There's a photo of him in the, like I was describing before, at the same table that Eisenhower and LBJ were with, but just with LBJ. And it doesn't look like he's there for long, the way he's positioned himself, just the way he looks. But then there's another photograph where he's in the White House and he's speaking at a podium. Truman, I'm talking of.
Right.
So they're all giving these statements, and there's a photograph of LBJ giving a press conference. That day too, same podium. So it looks like that's what they're called there for originally, but he obviously spent a lot of time getting advice from Eisenhower. And on the 24th, LBJ has this meeting where he calls all the governors that are in Washington to the White House and talks with them. And this is recounted in the Robert Caro book. And I quote a little bit from it, but he mentions to them that he talked with Eisenhower for quite some time the day before and got advice from him on how to get the exact phrase here, keep the country together.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing right there, Mike, is that was the thrust of the public display here, is that regardless of whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever, look, everybody stay calm. The government has not been decapitated despite the tragedy. We are still functional. We are still in control. You know, almost like the statement Alexander Haig decided to try and make that one day. Don't worry, I'm in control. No, we are still in control. Everything is okay. We're not in a state of emergency here. This is a terrible thing that happened, but all of us, whether we are past or present leaders, are all on the side of we're going to continue and we're going to get behind those that are still here and let us move forward. I think that was the general attitude that was attempted to be broadcast. Now, does that mean that that was what was going on behind the scenes? We don't necessarily know unless we've got some recordings of sorts and stuff like that. But Larry, What do you think about that? I mean, that is part of what's going on too, is the public display versus what's going on, you know, really behind the closed doors, right?
Well, there are two things. First, I'll give a bit of personal commentary. Having been there and listened to the news all that weekend and listened to a lot of people talking.
Well, true. Mike and I are only able to watch tapes. Mike and I are only able to watch tapes. You were actually, you know, alive at the time. Go ahead. Sorry.
There was nothing like that in terms of being stampeded. There was no, it's like JFK was in Texas and one of those crazy Texans shot him. Mm-hmm. You know, we had been going through all of the integration stuff, all the violence. Nobody at the time, you know, it was more like, you know, the president got shot. We all knew that a lot of people hated the president. There had been a lot of people threatening the president. And so I guess what strikes me off bad is I didn't hear anybody at all worried about continuity of government or being stampeded or concerned about the nation in general. It was more like, well, I wonder how long it will be before they catch the SOBs that shot him. It was being viewed as a crime, not as a national catastrophe.
I'm sorry, but you don't think there were some people, because I have taken a listen to some of the commentary that was broadcast in various parts of the country, and there was a bit of nervousness, depending on where you were, looking back at the broadcast record, regarding, you know, look, don't panic. I mean, it seemed to be like a universal thing, and again, regionally, it might have been presented a little differently, but it was sort of like, just because the president has fallen does not mean that the country's in trouble. There was a reason to broadcast that. Somebody had that thought. And go ahead.
I think what you got there is you're listening to the media channeling what's coming out of the White House.
Right.
The media was given those sorts of statements. And, you know, if you're out of the 60s, you know, the media often just flat reported. You know, that was damage control.
Right.
I mean, we saw the same thing happen over again. We saw after Martin Luther King was killed, the same messaging was done. Don't worry. You know, the immediate reaction is always damage control. Calm down, everybody. Project a message of calm. So, yeah, Chuck, I saw that, but I think we all just kind of like, well, okay, that's kind of what we would expect them to say. I'm just literally saying that at least – in the part of country I was in, everybody was looking at it as a crime, not as something that would have endangered the republic. You know, everybody knew it's Johnson. Johnson's the president now. That's how it works. Now, unless there's something there's not telling us, you know, unless it wasn't just a crime, then maybe we should be nervous. But the initial reaction was it was a crime. Mm-hmm. Somebody shot the president. The Russians are coming. That's the first thing that I would give you. The second thing is everything. It's like somebody threw a switch in the White House. You know, if you look at the conversations that were occurring, you know, you've got by Saturday, you have Hoover telling people to call the police in Dallas and shut up. Tell them to stop talking. Our problems aren't what happened. It's they're shooting their mouths off on TV, and they're saying things about other people. You know, somebody picked up Oswald in a station wagon. Somebody did. They need to shut up. We're not going to be able to take this under control if they don't stop. There are two things going on. The public face of the media, calm. The background immediately turning around to start controlling the narrative, as it were.
Mm-hmm. So with that in mind, when you're looking at this and you're studying this in your article, what else did you get to, Mike?
Can y'all give me a second? Someone's knocking on my door.
Certainly. Listen, I can sit and talk to Larry for a minute. Let us know when you're back.
I'll be right back in a second.
Sure. Look, all of that is true, but I find it interesting that they were promoting this, and it seems to me like there must have been a need for it. Because there was the idea, maybe in some segments of the public out there, that this could lead to a larger problem. Because I'm sure the concept of maybe somebody was responsible for this, especially because the media had come out and said, look, this guy was a Castro sympathizer. They were already sharing the tapes of, him getting arrested, and the Fair Play for Cuba Committee stuff was already circulating. So do you think that this was just an attempt to control the whole, listen, maybe he was a commie, but this isn't like we're going to war here over this.
Right. And the headlines, as you say, Chuck, there are already headlines saying, you know, Castro sympathizer kills president.
Right.
You know, in 1963, you know, we're worried about the Soviets. We're worried about the Cubans, you know. So, yeah, and I think Mike's back. But I think what Mike has done in this article is picked up again is that there were national security conversations going on with the CIA director and others that we don't know about.
Right.
It didn't get into the record, that we don't know the details of. And again, if it was just a lone gunman, why were those why an hour long conversation?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that really stands out. When you look at what they told Manchester, it's something entirely different. It's like, oh, we met in the hallway and talked for 3 minutes. Or Manchester goes, well, when Johnson got back to D.C., he talked to the Secretary of Defense at the airport and just asked him what was going on. Yeah, there are two radically different versions of what was going on behind the scenes.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly what, you know, to me, the real important thing is, it's not so much that these certain tapes are just gone or not, they're just missing or whatever the right phrase, they don't seem to exist, but it's what the implications of that are. Or, you know, I think that's...
Well, and there you go. Look,
hit like, the nail on the head.
Exactly. And say with the McGeorge Bundy thing, right? I mean, look, it could be a matter of transition. It could be a matter of, you know, listen, Mr. President, I know I was a JFK's guy, but I'm here to assist you in any way, and I just want you to know I'll do whatever it is I can to help you get in on whatever it is you need to be in on. And that takes 2 minutes, you know. I'm with you, Mr. President, kind of deal, right? Very simple. It doesn't need to be disappeared. It doesn't need to take an hour. There's a whole lot of issues here. So what is the content?
I mean, I didn't know. I mean, I was really surprised he spoke with him for an hour. I mean, that Hoover conversation, you know, we don't have the audio for, it's 15 minutes long. And, you know, I talk on the phone with people, done business stuff over the phone, mm-hmm. and an hour-long conversation, that's a long time. I
mean, well, especially with Hoover, because, you know, in all the
conversations... No, this is McGeorge Bundy.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was going to say, well, either way, McGeorge Bundy, that is a long conversation, but also...
Yeah, that's even more unusual.
Yeah, but if you were to take a look at, you know, Hoover, the way that he speaks, all right, and I haven't heard a lot of tape of McGeorge Bundy, honestly, but when you take a listen to tapes of Hoover, the guy doesn't waste a whole lot of time on the phone. You know what I mean? He doesn't make small talk. I don't get the impression that McGeorge Bundy did either. And also, again, this is a guy who's supposed to be very closely aligned with JFK. Now, he's part of the administration. Obviously, nobody else changed until Johnson changed him. And he retained the majority of the Kennedy administration, for sure. And in the immediate aftermath, he retained everybody, right? I mean, even Bobby Kennedy, briefly, right? So... You know, the idea that somebody might check in real quick and say, all right, look, I'm with you, whatever you need, you know, or some special thing. Look, I want you to make sure you know about this because only the president knew about it, something. Fine. But it doesn't take an hour. And that's pretty strange right there. And also, now that we don't have any idea what the content of that was, there you have it. So is there anything else that you discovered here? I mean, I want people to go read the article, so we won't talk about every single issue in it. But that's the main banner headline on it, right?
Yeah, no, I'm not trying to, you know, solve this assassination. I'm just trying to point out this stuff, and you know, it's details.
No, and certainly you're pointing out.
Let people look at it themselves.
Right, and it's a good thing to point out when something is odd in the record, and especially if it hasn't been pointed to previously or enough previously or et cetera. So... definitely a necessary
I would say
piece of
I'm
work.
I'm also
yeah.
writing this to try to also point out what I think is the great, you know, the great mystery of the assassination. One of them mm-hmm. isn't so much did Oswald do it or not. It's this whole Mexico City thing. And, you know, I don't know the, you know, I don't know the solution to it. More people have studied a lot more than I have, but, you know, Hoover told LBJ that, this person that went to the embassy or Soviet embassy in Mexico City, that it wasn't Oswald, you know, the voice on the tape didn't correspond to him.
Right.
And nor did the picture.
Yeah. So, the Cuban and Soviet embassy / consulates, because they are two separate places, but they are on the same compounds.
Let me add one other point about that too. Mm-hmm. According to the book, there's a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis that was written. What's the name of it?
Well,
slipping my mind.
What was the author? Who was the author?
Oh,
there have been a lot of books on it, so I'm just trying to get an idea.
Well, it'll come to me, but. In a minute, but the important thing is the guy that wrote the book, he did it with the help of researchers in the Soviet Union, or one researcher. You know, both these were academics, and the final failure, something like that, averting the something about to that effect. And anyway, the Soviet. A Russian author, he had access to the KGB Soviet records. Mm-hmm. And at the end, One Hell of a Gamble, that's the name of the book. At the end of the last chapter or two, this is the book that reveals the story, that Robert Kennedy sent an emissary after the assassination that contacted someone in the KGB and this person told them they thought it was a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. But according to the Soviet researcher, a Russian researcher, the KGB determined it was a conspiracy right after the event because they didn't believe a letter that Oswald had sent to the Soviet embassy in Washington, D.C. was written by him. Uh-huh. They thought it was a forgery. And
you're not talking about you're not talking about averting the final failure. As a book, are you?
It's called One Hell of a Gamble.
Oh, One Hell of a Gamble. Okay. No, because you mentioned the phrase final failure, so okay.
Yeah, One Hell of a Gamble. That's what it's called.
Okay, fair enough. No, I was just curious. All right, well, yeah, no, there was a lot going on here. And the idea that the identity of the individual that is named Lee Harvey Oswald going to Mexico City, that is still a, you know, what do they call it on the other side of the pond, a controversy. But there's definitely controversy over this thing, Americanized. And, you know, was it actually him? Was it somebody else? Was it, you know, something that was planned by someone for a purpose, et cetera? I mean, that's still an issue. And, indeed, you know, Hoover had stated in more than one place, including in his own annotation on a memo at one point, that he thought he was lied to regarding this by the CIA. So, you know, who was in charge of the surveillance, to the best of my knowledge, of both the embassy and consulate of the Cubans and the Russians in Mexico City. And this has been a much debated and discussed topic for, well, since the events, pretty much, Larry, right?
Yeah, and I have one more question for Mike. And, you know, Chuck, I'm always interested in timelines. That fascinates me.
Of course.
So, Mike, when you look at what you found and the additional kind of holes that you found where – it looks like a conversation occurred that we don't have any insight into. I would say that started the night of the assassination with the Johnson-Hoover call. How long do these holes last? Do they last through Saturday, Sunday, Monday? Where are they really in time?
Well, I only looked at the day, the 23rd and 24th. So I'm not sure, you know, they could, I mean, I don't know if they're going, I don't know if that's it. I don't know the answer to the question.
Well, but the ones you saw were all on Saturday and Sunday, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And that was my impression too, that whatever was going on here that we don't know about happened over Saturday and Sunday. And just my personal thesis, we do know that there was a national security meeting with the CIA director on Sunday morning. We only know that because it shows up in a meeting log, not the president's. But there's no transcript or no record of what was just all my impression from all of this is that all went on right up to the point where Hoover is ordered and orders his people to write a report that Oswald lit up by himself. And that at pretty much at that point in time, that decision was made. But all of this dialogue that we don't know about was really in front of that on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. So I'm interested of this first week and in LBJ in particular. Right. And so I know I don't have the timeline in front of me when I say this, but I know that within a few days after the assassination, that Johnson had a meeting with Desmond Fitzgerald, I think John McCone, probably McGeorge Bundy, about Cuba and the Cuba operations. He basically shut it all down. Mm. You know, they were trying to – they're telling them stuff Castro's doing in Central America, trying to – and he just had no interest in, you know, any of the operations they were doing.
Well, the general idea – yeah, the general idea that I've been given to take on into my mind is that – Johnson switched gears and wanted to get out of the business of worrying about Cuba. And a lot of people would argue that he immediately started to focus on Vietnam the moment that he, you know, stepped into the office and shut down this stuff regarding the operations.
And I've seen, too, in some of the files releases, the new files, at least they're new to me. You know, they right. may be old files re-released again.
Sure.
But the FBI... looked at this Mexico City. There's an allegation that Oswald had met with a Cuban when he was in Mexico City and got money from him. Mm-hmm. A witness claimed that, who right. was an anti-Castro activist with some sort of CIA connection. And the ambassador was trying to push it. And mm-hmm. The FBI basically debunked the whole thing. And then the CIA also debunked it. In these okay. records. What I'm trying to say is it does, I think the idea that you, I think you have that this whole Oswald in Mexico City and possible conspiracy of that, as being him involved with the Soviets or the Cubans, it seems like that all went away, mm-hmm. And was then, you know, John, it is completely dropped and, you know, as a topic for Johnson to talk about, and then the FBI and the CIA itself debunked it.
Fair enough.
In the days that followed. That's what it appears to me.
Gotcha. Fair enough. Well, look, I'm going to let you get out of here, Mike, because I know I've kept okay. you over time. But before I do, just one quick question just to make sure here, because I'm going to give people a link. The name of the book that I came across here is One Hell of a Gamble, Khrushchev, Castro, and Kennedy. And that's got two authors. Looks like one of them is Timothy Naftali or something. And
that's correct.
That's okay, so that's the book. So I'm going to give you guys the link to that in the show notes in case you want to go look at it, look at the reviews of it or whatever, since that's the book you're referring to. But kind of want to let Larry tie a bow on this unless you got something else you want to add, Mike?
No, I'm curious to see what Larry has to say.
There you go. Larry, I mean, what is the general takeaway here? I mean, Mike has written an interesting article here pointing out, again, another discrepancy in the records. Are we surprised at another discrepancy in the records? Absolutely not. What is the purpose for it? Where did the tape go? You mentioned a great thing, which I would suggest people take a look at Bill Kelly's work on, you know, what in the hell happened to the Air Force One tape. But, you know, because that's been a controversy for a while, too. We had what we were told for a long time was the complete recording. It is not. And it's interesting that we've had a couple of different versions of that leak out here and there. I don't know if there's any possibility of somebody having some reel-to-reel sitting in a closet of this somewhere. But stranger things have happened, Larry. I mean, let's be honest. What do you take away from this entire circumstance and what Mike had to write and the issue at hand?
I really appreciate Mike doing that. A couple of the things he found were brand new to me, and to me that carries the story forward. I mean, the fascinating thing is that we sort of assume that we pretty well know the history of the assassination after the assassination, uh-huh. Right? At least as far as what was going on in government, because it's not like documents, not like our document quest, where we know about documents and they're not giving them to, they're redacting them, they're not releasing. Right. We kind of figured that once Manchester did his groundbreaking work, you know, you could read that book and you've got a grip on it. And I think most historians have said, well, with what we've got in the way of the tapes and the transcripts and his research, the oral histories, we know what happened. And I really like Mike's work expanding that, because I don't think we do. And I think we've deluded ourselves to some extent thinking that we know what happened with those national security level decisions and gotten sucked into, in a way, seeking documents where those documents aren't going to resolve it, because those conversations, if they were held and recorded, we're not going to have them. Mm-hmm. And in many cases, I don't think they were recorded. So we just need to understand that by kind of fixating on documents, we may be missing the point that there's other stuff missing that tells a larger story than what's in the actual documents.
There you go. And look, Larry, if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you to stick around for a couple of minutes after we take a short break, just because there are some questions that have come in with the live audience, and I'd like to address them real sure. fast. And then I'll let you get on out of here, too. But first, let's let Mike go, because I've already kept him about, 20 minutes later than I said I would. Sorry about that, Mike. I hope I'm not holding you up from anything.
Oh, no.
All right. Well, look, I appreciate it. Are you going to be back next week, by the way, or are we skipping a week?
I'm not sure. It's like 50-50. All right. I'll know in a few days.
No problem. Look, you let me know. You have my phone number now, so I have a phone. So now you can text me or call me if you like, and we could talk about it. But in the meantime, I'll be glad to have you back on whenever you get back on. Of course, everybody go over to WallStreetWindow.com and read this article, which is of interest to begin with, and the title, let me just roll it in front of me again, The Mystery of the Missing JFK Assassination Related LBJ Presidential Tapes, The First 72 Hours, Mike Swanson. It's an article on WallStreetWindow.com. There's lots of stuff over there. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. Mike is also the author of The War State and Why the Vietnam War. But we're gonna torture Larry Hancock with a couple of your questions in the next segment, and I'll plug his website when he's on his way out the door. But meanwhile, Mike, thanks so much for doing this work and for coming on and talking with us about it tonight.
Thank you. Great to do it.
Absolutely thrilled. And yeah, go over there, read this, especially if you're interested in the topic. And even if you're not, get over there and read WallStreetWindow.com. Anyway, the Ocelli Effect will continue after this, still with Larry Hancock on the line. Stick around.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times, and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Uncle, do you remember that time when Benjamin Fulford said that an Asian secret society was going to dispatch ninjas to take down the Illuminati?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, in the cartoon.
Yeah, did that ever work out too good?
No.
It didn't, did it?
Didn't work.
But here on Ocelli.com Radio Network, things work out a bit better, don't they?
Much better.
I mean,
it's clearer in understanding about the programs. The programs are much clearer getting live people into it. They really have a good conversation going.
Much better.
Much better scene.
I say forget Benjamin Fulford and his ninjas and listen to the Ocelli.com radio network.
I agree. It's straight to the point.
Straight talk.
And I like that idea.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim. Oswald girlfriend. He knew Ruby and Barry. Cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination spoken to her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War, by author Mike Swanson.
Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? This thing called nuclear weapons and other things, like lots of, you know what uranium is, right? Bad things. Things are done with uranium, including some bad things. Nuclear Holocaust. You know what uranium is, right? I've been briefed. Nuclear Holocaust.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Get ready for the Ocelli Effect.
Third and final and probably very short segment of the Ocelli Effect tonight with author Larry Hancock. Now, during the broadcast where we were discussing these missing LBJ tapes with Mike Swanson and Larry, we got a few questions in, so I wanted to take a moment to ask them and also check up with Larry. I mean, if there's anything else he wants to add in, obviously, I would give him the floor any which way he wants it. Larry-Hancock.com. There will be a link down in the show notes to Larry's blog, as well as a bunch of links to his books, stuff like that. I try and rotate things around, give you guys different things to look at, but endorse every single book that is authored by one of my, again, long-standing and very lucky to have him co-hosts here on the show, Larry Hancock. So definitely recommend all of his work. Larry, is there anything else we need an update on or anything you'd like to add to the previous conversation we might have not gotten to?
The one thing I would add, and Mike mentioned it a bit, I love timelines because I just think chronology can tell you a lot. In the 2010 version of Someone Would Have Talked, I spent a great deal of effort working on the timeline relating to Johnson's activities in the 72 hours following the assassination. Mm-hmm. So if anybody is really into that, I think I can recommend it. It's the sort of thing if I were editing it, I'd go in back in and insert the calls that Mike's talking about in his blog because I think they're very germane to that. But I literally think there's a story that's often missed just in looking at who talked to who, and then talk to someone else, and when did Johnson start, you know, what was Johnson, during what period of time was he really concerned about what Hoover had told him, mm-hmm. during what part of time did they make that go away, and it went away just like Hoover going to my agents have listened to the tapes from Mexico, and he says that on Saturday, and by Sunday you're going, everybody's going, well, there were no tapes. They were erased. Nobody listened to anything. Yeah, right. I would insert that in that to anyone that's really interested in what we often call the cover-up or the damage control really needs to have that timeline firmly in mind. And I just would point out that that is in the book as a starter if anyone is interested.
Excellent. Yeah, well, as someone would have talked, various versions of it, you know, it's been updated a few times, and definitely that's a great addition. Now, as far as other records that are, this is going to pertain to the questions, but let me just start off with this. You know, a couple, maybe, I'm saying a couple, no, I'm wrong, about a decade ago, Larry, okay, you know, time starts to blur for you when you're looking at, this only came out a couple years ago. If you've been looking at something for 40 years, 30 years, you might say, it's a couple of years ago. But remember the big sort of, you know, fanfare that was given to the tapes of Jackie speaking a few years ago? They made a nice audio book out of it. And it was her talking to, what was it, Salinger, right? A few years ago, and they put out CDs so you could actually hear the tapes. I remember at that time a discussion about what was still being withheld by the Kennedy family. And the idea was that at that point that Caroline Kennedy had to sign off on releasing things. And you bring up William Manchester. There's an extensive pile of interviews with Jackie Kennedy immediately following, or at least not immediately, but following the assassination, where she spoke supposedly, reportedly, rather candidly to William Manchester. We have not seen those tapes yet, right? Now, the questions that are coming in, a couple of them are about the JFK Records Collection Act, and what about the special circumstances for stuff like that? Because, again, there was public and private hands. It was all supposed to be collected. What about things like that where the Kennedy family has kind of held those things back still?
That's a very interesting point. The issue and the problem with that is that it was part of a contractual agreement between the Kennedy family and Manchester, mm-hmm. in terms of his doing the book and in regard to those interviews. And those interviews are probably seminal. Those interviews would be extremely important. However, because that wasn't a government document or anything related to the government investigations or the Warren Commission, that sets outside material that could be released per se. I mean, the government can't release it because the government never held it. No mm-hmm. federal agency ever held it. Right. Only William Manchester held it. And to some extent, this is like some of the films mm-hmm. from Dealey Plaza. Those are actually records of the event related to the assassination, but they weren't produced, prepared. They're not government documents. So to get them, it's a civil matter. Right. At least that's the way it sets right now. And the Kennedy family has shown no signs of – and it's not just that, Chuck. I know of some interviews done with Robert Kennedy in regard to the assassination, in regard to Vietnam, mm-hmm. that even though, you know, they're done with someone who was a government official, you can't get to them without the lawyer for the family permission giving access. The same way goes to certain medical materials. Right. So that all sets outside of what the government essentially owns control of, so it is only the Kennedy family who can release them. Now, there is an argument that those should have been pursued aggressively mm-hmm. by the Assassination Records Review Board. And we know right. the Assassination Records Review Board did at least pursue the subject of private materials, not just with the Kennedys, but with other people, such as Kennedy's a doctor when he was in the White House. So it's not that the ARB did not reach out and ask for certain materials, but if the individual who was the legal owner of them decided to tell their lawyer to say no, then that's where it sits. And we would actually have to have new legislation or some kind of a directive issued to collect those private materials from the Kennedy family. Otherwise, we're not going to get them. So, unfortunately, the answer to your question is they are pertinent to the JFK assassination. There's no doubt about that. Mm-hmm. But they're beyond you know, the reach of government, reach out to government documents.
See, now that's a strange thing, because in the legislation it does say, you know, that things that are held by the public are subject to this collection. But same time, it's not just that simple. Now, the direct question was asked if there was a special provision given to the Kennedy family or to Jackie regarding this, and that's not a single answer question, because you have the stuff that's under a deed of gift in the National Archives. Technically speaking, it's collected, right? But
right.
Is it being shared with the public? For instance, the easiest one to point to is the autopsy records. Those things are not shared with the public, the photos and such. Are they collected? They're there under a deed of gift,
right,
with the archives. Now, that doesn't mean the public gets to see them, but they did collect them.
You can appeal to the family's lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you can make a request to view them, but it has to be on an item-by-item basis, and it's their prerogative. So, yeah, even though they weren't, in this case, they weren't collected. They were given, as you say, as a deed of gift.
Right.
In the Manchester materials, neither. They could not be collected, nor were they given. And
right.
There are other things of that same nature. But, yeah, that's a good point to differentiate the deed of gift items from the withheld, or essentially private property items.
Right. Well, and here's the thing. To my knowledge, there's no special rider where there was, like, an exemption given or, well, we're just,
no,
you know, anything like that. To the best that I know of, and I remember reading this whole thing, I used to have they released, you know, the government printing office does release these things. And I got one of those, you know, printed booklets. You know, they release any law, pretty much. You can request a printed copy of for a while. I don't know if you still can. But in the 90s, I got my officially printed government printing office copy of the Records Collection Act, right? And I do remember that there was no special rider in there or anything about it.
No, the ARB had the power, and this is – I've investigated some of the ARRB could have taken a couple of different approaches to literally forcefully collect them.
Right.
I mean, they can go with the eminent domain. They can actually make a legal case that the government deserves access to them and the public deserves access to them. The ARRB in no case decided to do that. The same thing applied in New Orleans. The district attorney in New Orleans privately seized and personally held a great number of documents related to the Garrison investigation, which you'd consider germane.
The grand jury proceeding specifically was part of that.
And the ARB went to them, and he said no. And the staff member who was in charge of the collections ultimately resigned over the issue that they were being tasked with doing a job that was impossible because ARB staff and counsel wouldn't support it.
Right. And we had a variety of results here with attempting to collect things in private hands. For instance, the Zapruder film, right, where you have an issue where there had to be a settlement there. And what did that cost? $14 million, I think, eventually?
Insane, but yes. For the government to pay for something, well, anyway, but there were a variety of solutions, none of them good.
Right. I mean, and in that case, just in short order, and I know you'll correct me if I'm inaccurate about this, but bottom line is, here you go. There was a copy of the Zapruder film that was then donated to charity to offset the tax gain from gaining the $14 million, which they turned around and gave, but same time, that was the negotiation in order to collect the Zapruder film, the original. Okay.
Well, that's absolutely right. And of course, the other thing is essentially the government bought it. but didn't for the public, right?
But, yeah, but the punchline, go ahead.
The punchline would be that the government did not hold it and make it accessible to the public. The government gave it and the rights to access to it to the Sixth Floor Museum in Dallas.
Well,
like,
there's,
wait a minute.
There's that. But in addition, here's the funny part. They didn't actually end up getting the copyright. So the copyright was still not held by the U.S. government. And technically speaking, I mean, you can go to the archives and you can get what they call a forensic copy of this thing. But it's an expensive pain in the neck to get. Anyway, as I said,
and it's not access to the original.
No, it's still not access to the original, but you can get a copy. And not even a convenient copy, like, hey, look, let me just go down there and get one on a DVD. No, nothing like that. I mean, literally. Anyway, just saying, there's a variety of
circumstances. In terms of the question, something new would have to happen to acquire Manchester's interviews, and, you know, which is really sad because, that's one of the bigger holes. It's fascinating that one of the bigger holes in the missing history is out there and is definitely withheld virtually forever.
Well, unless, the inheritor of the estate, right? Mm. Caroline Kennedy, I believe, is the only person who has control, right, at this point?
Mm-hmm.
But I imagine that the grandchildren could inherit control over that issue, right?
True,
Jackie's grandchildren, I mean to say. But other than that, I mean, sorry, Larry, go ahead.
I just said longer view.
Oh yeah, longer view.
You're absolutely right. Down the road.
But that's it. And Caroline, you know, as I said, she did release. I think it was Salinger that she had the conversations with there. And I know I had a copy. I've had a couple of copies of that. But I know I very anxiously went out and got myself one right away. Very little controversy on there, but a couple of interesting statements Jackie made. I'll tell you that. And she certainly was speaking in a very candid way. Unlike any of her public pronouncements and presentations, although some of it was very typical of her, but there were certain points at which I feel like she sort of loosened up during the conversation with Salinger, and I can only imagine what she might have had behind the protective wall with Manchester there, and as a matter of fact, that's all we can imagine, because we only have a couple of references to it, maybe, by Manchester himself, but who knows what was on the rest of the tape, you know? Regarding accounts immediately following the assassination. Who knows what else could be filled out based on Jackie's word in the chronology, so to speak, regarding the events surrounding the assassination. Right, Larry?
Oh, absolutely. In particular, not necessarily what she knew directly, but what Robert Kennedy may have told her.
Mm. And that's another thing, is that RFK, there's various records that are held by the family there. And we don't necessarily have access to all that. Now, meanwhile, he was the attorney general. He was the president's brother. And there's a great many revelation that could be contained within. Just saying. But there's multiple children there in play as far as who controls that and probably would have a say. And I don't know the legal ins and outs of the RFK estate. But I imagine that Ethel certainly had something to say about it for quite a while. And there you go. And they've kept a lot of stuff kind of to themselves over the years, one way or another. So, anyways, anything else that we need to add here, Larry, or are you about done with me for the night?
No, I think that does it. It's kind of good to visit. We spend so much time talking about, you know, what the CIA has withheld or what the FBI, you know, about what the federal agencies might not have given us. This is good because you know, we often don't talk about the other parts that we don't get that might have filled in the story. But no, I think I'm good. I'm glad that Mike did that. I thought that was a really interesting post, and it fills in some more areas for me, without a doubt, that kind of expand that story of the first 72 hours. And what was happening behind closed doors.
And really quickly, interestingly enough, as I pointed out,
not just happening between closed doors, because one of the fascinating parts of it is it certainly gives you the suspicion that at the time they were having the conversations or having the calls or talking to each other, things were very open. Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't any plan to follow a script or anything. It was only after the fact that people started going, oh, you know, maybe we ought to take that phone call off the record, or maybe, no, I didn't talk to any, okay.
Yeah.
And everybody couldn't get their story straight among themselves, which is hilarious.
Yeah,
I wasn't supposed to mention I talked to him. Okay.
I'm thinking to myself, they didn't quite know whose ass it needed to be covered yet. You know what I mean? I know that's a little crude on my part, but whatever. I think, you know, the CYA thing, that's what it was. Who do we got to cover? Oh, okay. And I think that's much the same story with the Air Force One tape. You know, again, I point to Bill Kelly because he made the loudest noise regarding this. And the fact that we did not have the complete thing. Doug Horn, I know, has discussed it. You're aware of the issue with the incomplete Air Force One transmissions, right?
I think that's, and I worked with Bill a lot on that, and of course Doug Horn brought it up, but I think one of the most significant thing there is along the same lines. It's the tapes, Air Force One tapes were good. Nobody bothered about them. Nobody worried about them. Nobody even knew about them until about, by my memory, about 8 or 9 months after the fact, when someone came to the White House from the media and asked to listen to them. So it became known that they existed. Mm-hmm. And it was at that point in time that Johnson himself personally ordered them taken back, reviewed, and quote, and literally edited, not, I won't say edited, but reviewed for release, mm-hmm. which clearly means that somebody went through them, and what was released for us to listen to is undoubtedly not the full set of communications.
Incomplete.
So Johnson was concerned enough about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, why would President Johnson, like a lot of things on his plate, like Vietnam, a lot of things on his plate at that point in time, but he went through the trouble to make sure that conversations, not everything on that was going to come forth, which I find fascinating.
And I'm certain that he wasn't worried about, you know, Rose Kennedy telling him, that, you know, we're thankful that you were a good friend to Jack and we're behind you, Mr. Yeah. President. I'm certain that that's not what he was worried about.
Yeah. Don't think that was it, but yeah, that's a good point. It sounds so social, you know, when you listen to it. It's just right. Like Johnson is making social calls, political calls, sympathy calls, and you sort of going, did anybody tell him that he was the commander in chief? Nope, he didn't even worry. And then somebody says, well, on the plane ride back, he talked to somebody on the plane and said he wondered if the missiles were flying, right? It's kind of like, wait a minute. That just is not right. Did he not ask the Secretary of Defense?
You would think that he would have enough knowledge to know who he should ask about that kind of thing. And I just he had been around a minute. It's not like he was new to the organization, okay? I'm just saying. But anyway, Larry, again, go over to larry-hancock.com. I'll give you the link to Larry's blog as well, which, by the way, I was going to focus on a bit, but then we ran out of time going through a few different things here. But I would urge you to check out Larry's blog. Although his last entry was in February, I think we're going to see some new stuff from him soon. And I would advise you follow that. And also, I'm looking forward to, I don't know if you want to talk about it yet, I'm looking very forward to a piece you're working on that also relates to tonight's subject a bit. Are you prepared to say anything about that at all?
Oh, I will. I'm slogging away. I've decided, it just kind of like the conversation we're having tonight, I've been at this for 30 years, looked at lots of sources, and after a period of time, sometimes you need to do a reset and revisit what you looked at before and start checking things together, looking at different sources, looking for continuity and consistency. And I'm doing that with Lee Harvey Oswald. A lot of what I thought about Lee Harvey Oswald, a lot about I wrote about Lee Harvey Oswald, I got out of JFK books, mm-hmm. assassination research books. And I have started looking at some other sources and doing some other comparisons, and I'm doing a reset on Oswald's personality, his character, his behaviors, to kind of get a new insight on what was going on with him in 1963. And I'll be very blunt about it. I find Oswald to be much more of an independent actor mm-hmm. than perhaps he's been profiled in the past by either the Warren Commission or the JFK community. Not that I'm going to switch sides. I still consider him a total patsy, but I consider the point that he was much more inclined to act on his own agendas
right.
rather than the kind of passive person that just sat around taking orders from people.
Right. And look, I certainly, you know, just like the last presentation we did regarding, regarding that situation, Dudna is his last name, right, Greg?
Greg
Dowda. Yeah, Dowda. Sorry. See, I did it again. I got to have him back on, by the way. But I think regarding the Walker shooting, like we talked about there, it is good to take a look at things with fresh eyes, even if they're not our own. If somebody else is willing to take a good, solid, objective run at some of these things, it may be better for all of us to reexamine these things from time to time, because new information emerges. New perspectives are possible, and we may get a whole lot closer to the nuances of the reality than we were before if we continue to continuously test and reexamine what it is we might have taken for granted in the past. So I think that's always necessary, and that's part of what we do on this show. So appreciate it, Larry. Again, larry-hancock.com. I can endorse all of his books. I'm not going to list them all, but I already have, and I've done presentations on every one of them. Actually hope to talk to you about this new piece on Oswald with a reexamination as soon as it's ready. But in the meantime, we'll talk to Larry Hancock again in a couple of weeks. And for you guys, I'll be talking to you again tomorrow night. So no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember, I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Want to thank Mike Swanson and Larry Hancock for putting up with me for, almost 2 hours tonight. Anyway, take care.